And we're live with our 330th episode of Absolute AppSec. I'm Ken Johnson at CK Tricky on social media, joined by my co-host Seth Law at Seth Law on social media. Seth, say hi.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another episode. We've been out of pocket for a couple of weeks attending Hacker Summer Camp and doing trainings and meetups and attending talks and villages and all the things. I do have a post coming out fairly soon on my thoughts on DEF CON after, you know, DEF CON and Black Hat, I should say, after, you know, however many years we've been going to it. That being said, I do not recommend being in Vegas for more than 3 days. Anything over 10 is just egregious and zero stars. Just, I'm going to put that out there. At this point, I am feeling a little bit recovered, though. It was great to see everyone and actually see the community in general. But just a couple of housekeeping items. I am really excited to talk with Jivan today, friend, colleague. Just on everything they're doing over at Rippling. We're going to get to that shortly. I only have a couple of announcements. As far as training goes, we're looking for additional kind of opportunities and places to train our Agentic AppSec or AI Enhanced Application Security course has been picked up for Black Hat Europe. I think we are going to reprise that just as long as it sells. Otherwise, I did want to give a shout out to Guard Square today for sponsoring this episode. Think about your mobile app's source code. Once it hits the App Store, it's out in the wild, and without the right protection, decompiling is easy for malicious actors looking to steal your IP or tamper with your software. That's where GuardSquare comes in. GuardSquare provides the highest level of mobile app security for Android and iOS applications and SDKs. Their advanced tools integrate seamlessly into your CI/CD pipeline. We're talking polymorphic, multi-layered code hardening techniques and automated runtime application self-protection, paired with mobile application security testing and real-time threat monitoring to deliver the highest level of mobile app security without compromise. Don't leave your hard work exposed. Secure your mobile applications today. Go to guardsquare.com to learn more. So again, thanks to GuardSquare. We've talked about them in the past. ProGuard has been a recommendation for Android applications for a number of years, but they do have a more advanced protection. If you are in that space, please give them a shout out and give them a look. As far as other items go, any teaser thoughts on DEF CON before we jump into the discussion with Jivan?
Well, I wasn't there for the conference,
Oh, that's right. You abandoned me for 2 days. I remember now.
Yes, I did abandon you. Yeah. Seemed like everybody went to the conference and it still was there. So good job for still existing.
No, it's all good.
What did you think of it?
We'll get into my thoughts later. Let me finish putting them down on paper, and then we can jump into it. Because I know we have a fascinating topic with Jivan today, specifically around this idea of a vulnerability jail and what they're doing at Rippling and their experience. So, Jivan, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you. It's been a while. I think the last time I was on was actually joined Rippling. So that's nearly 3 years ago, which is crazy. Oh, wow. And we talked about me, I'm done with management. I'm going to finally become an IC. And I think 6 weeks later, I became a manager again at Rippling.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
no good deed goes unpunished, right?
Yeah, it's been a wild ride. They've seen some incredible growth at Rippling for the company, but also for the security team. I think there was a team of 5 product security engineers. I want to say 18 or 19. I do have an open headcount as well. So it's been incredible the last just about 3 years.
Did you say 18 to 19 ProdSec engineers?
That's right.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Before we get to the vulnerability jail, I want to talk about that for a little bit. Like, what is your ratio of, you know, product security engineers to just regular engineers?
Yeah. It is 1 to 60, I think. Usually I usually count the entire security engineering team when I do the ratios just in general. So that one's way better. I think we have about 50 in security engineering. But with ProdSec specifically, it's about 1 to 60. And it's been pretty good. The way that we hire security engineers, like, they have to have really deep technical capabilities so that we're writing a lot of code. Sometimes we're actually writing production controls as well. So a member of our team, he built out the server-side request forgery library, and we implemented it across the entire ecosystem. We do sometimes we embed with engineering teams and we fix another class of vulnerabilities with them. But we have really, really deep technical knowledge, everyone A to Z on the team. So the ratio has been great. Working with engineering has been great as well. We have leadership team actually really cares about security. So it's always nice to go to a company where they're not just saying that they care about security, they actually do care about security. So yeah, it's been definitely a pleasure being able to roll out a program to where we are today.
Yeah, that was why I was asking that question, right? Like, that's obviously a management decision to invest in the security team. Like, 1 to 60 feels like an appropriate ratio. I end up dealing with a lot of third parties, as a third party going into organization where it's, 500-600 developers and there's like two security people, security engineers at all, right? Like, and they're trying to handle everything from DevSecOps to ProdSec to AppSec to GRC, right? And that seems to be more of the model that I run into, at least in the small to mid-sized businesses that aren't necessarily in the tech space. But it does feel like a little bit of it would be a nice like change of pace, I shall say, from what I normally see.
Yeah, I've been lucky with my career. A lot of the companies that I've worked at actually, I've been in where I started off my security career, where I was the lone security engineer. We had about 150 engineers at that point, so I got a good feel for 1 to 150, and all sorts of doing Dart, but also InfraSec, mm-hmm. application security, helped doing a little bit of stuff on the GRC side as well. So good feel for that, and to a place like Segment, Twilio, Rippling, where the ratios are much, much better. We are able to get much deeper into the stack and really help the organization think about security at a foundational level.
Well, I love your anecdote or your story about the SSRF, actually creating that library internally from a ProdSec team. That feels like the ideal to me, right? Like that's where I like to see that actually happening. And this argument went on at DEF CON, right? Like, we're still having this discussion about what is AppSec, what is ProdSec, right? Like, and where these duties actually lie and the different efforts. And that's one of the things that I've always argued, is that the ProdSec team is security engineers, but they're developers and they're creating that sort of library, that sort of functionality for the wider team to use. So they're actually affecting code at the code level, writing, spinning that out. And I know GitHub did the same thing. So cool. Well, and, that's great, right? Kudos, I guess, on you on, finding the organizations that support it well. It speaks to you actually interviewing them as opposed to just them interviewing you, right? Making sure you have the right support.
Absolutely. And I always want to make sure that the people that I interview understand that as well. So I have a staff role open. I make sure that I spend maybe 40 minutes of the time doing my interview with them, and then they get 20 minutes. It's a staff role. It's a lot more seniority. They should dive deeper, make sure that everything looks legit. There's some great things about Rippling. There's some challenging things about Rippling. I'm not afraid to share anything so that they can dive deeper and really understand if this is a good fit for them.
Yeah, makes sense. Cool. I don't know, Ken, in your current role, right? I know GitHub had a pretty strong ProdSec team as well when you were over there. But as you talk to companies, do you see that same sort of ratio, a dry runs perspective? No.
No. GitHub and Rippling sound fairly unique. Rippling being, you said, 18 or 19, and the team at GitHub was now, do you have a pcert in as part of your team as well?
We do the pcert function ourselves. So and most of it's usually bug bounty researchers finding critical vulnerabilities. So we take care of the incident response side of that from that standpoint.
That actually answers my next question. So yeah, I mean, I would say then that like that's pretty representative. It sounds like of what we did at GitHub, and it was maybe a few people more than that, but it was roughly around there. I don't see that anymore. I actually see is just like more challenges and less headcount. So like, I'll throw out a couple examples of some newer challenges, like threat intel, malicious packages are being released a bit faster. We were talking about it before the call. So there's like this concept of, we could be attacked before we even know about the fact that we need to respond to something, or having like an agent swarm like you're talking about and being like Mythos ready is another. I don't know if that's actually like a technical challenge or if that's more of a, I'm being asked and now this is becoming a problem that is manufactured and has not manufactured in that it couldn't be real, but that like right now I'm not like afraid of being Mythos ready or whatever that means. But those are the kind of things that, so those are my two examples of challenges I see people face, but I don't see headcount getting better. I don't know if you have other challenges you're facing that you didn't face 3 years ago.
I think I'm more fearful now than I was 3 years ago. Things are moving so fast and just trying to stay on top of things. I think that's the biggest challenge in itself. And I think we talked a little bit about vulnerability jail. It ramped up at Rippling after Mythos. So we really talked about some of the challenges that we would need to, how do we need to react to a Mythos type of situation? And now with the OpenAI Hugging Face challenges, I think we have to relook at that again and see, do we have to take it up another level as the security industry?
Yeah. Well, let's get into that, right? Like, we've mentioned vulnerability jail.
Did a lot of work. Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mentioned vulnerability jail a couple of times, but actually, from your perspective, like, what is the definition of a vulnerability jail, right?
Yeah.
Like what is the task that you're trying to accomplish there? There might be listeners that have never heard that term before, so I want to make sure it gets defined.
Yeah, I'm going to take it back a little bit. I'm going to give a lot more context. So in the past, we might have talked about democratizing vulnerability management, where we want to empower our engineering org to do the right thing. So if a vulnerability comes in, it's assigned a particular severity, say it is a high severity vulnerability. If the engineering team can't fix it on time, the right level in the organization would be able to approve the SLA for the SLA extension for it. So at Segment and Twilio, it was like engineering manager can approve the SLA extension for lows and mediums. The highs went to the VPs, and then the criticals went to the CEO at Segment, which was a smaller company in comparison, or the GM at Twilio. So having that sort of workflow ensured that the right level was looking at vulnerabilities. So a VP paying attention to high vulnerabilities, there was one particular VP at Segment. He looked at it and say, hey, this is the second time you've asked for an extension request for us. If something goes wrong, it's going to be my fault. And people are going to blame me because I'm the one that signed off on the extension. So he wouldn't sign off on the extension until he knew who was going to work on it, what the plan was, and how long it was going to take. And so I think the engineering team said it's going to take 2 weeks. They got the extension approved. They got it fixed in like 4 days because they did not want to go back for an extension request. So the democratized vulnerability management program worked really, really well at Segment and Twilio. We rolled it out at Rippling, and it didn't work as well. There were just so many vulnerabilities over SLA, VPs took time to accept the extension requests. It was just challenging overall. So from that, the concept of vulnerability jail was born. And what is vulnerability jail? Basically, if you have a vulnerability that goes over SLA, we actually prevent the team, the engineering team that has a vulnerability going over SLA, from being able to merge their PRs into the main or default branches. They can still generate PRs, but they can't merge them into the default branches. And we are a monolith at Rippling. So if you can't merge into the monolith, you're out of luck. This really got us excited, the concept. And before we were able to roll it out, we wanted to make sure that we had leadership buy-in. So we met with the CTO, CSO, make sure that they were completely aligned, and they were. And so much so that our CTO talked about it at R&D all hands. Before we rolled it out, he told the R&D organization, hey, we're gonna do this concept of vulnerability jail. This is what's going to happen. These are the consequences. Security is really important to us here. We need to make sure that we pay attention to it. So having the CTO talk about it at R&D all hands made sure that the heat was off of us on the security side. Everyone knew that Alberta was aligned to it, so that there was no concerns or complaints. And having said that, all of Albert's directs, the CTO's directs, have been fantastic security champions as well. So if they do see vulnerabilities coming up to be due, they do apply a pressure within their orgs. So it was fantastic when I was in some DM channels with one of the VPs, and they asked engineering manager asked for an extension for high severity vulnerability. And the VP was like, no, you have enough time. I want you to fix it. So it's nice to see that pushback coming from engineering and not always coming from security.
Yeah, that's that's fascinating to me that it feels like kind of stars aligning in order to make something like that work.
And, yeah.
The risk register process or the vulnerability democratization I have seen work in some organizations, and then others it just gets ignored or they just hit approve, right? I think that might have been a similar effect. Is that what you were seeing at Rippling and the reason that you went to it's almost like a more extreme version of vulnerability democratization, right?
Yeah. So the challenges at Rippling are usually because a product has such tight deadlines, and especially in the age of AI, expectations are very high on engineers. I definitely empathize with them. They're getting hit by all different angles. You have product that's challenging them. You have customer support. You have security. You have other platform teams that are challenging the engineering teams. So they're getting hit by all these different angles. And having a mechanism to show that there are consequences if you don't do something had made it easier for them to reprioritize some of their work.
You're right. Developers are, not only are they asked to ship more and more and more, but we talked about this ahead of time where they might be constrained as well on things like token usage. So it's like, use AI to build things faster. Also, don't use it too much AI though, because it costs money and that's bad. We want the things, we don't want to spend the money. So I have one question about all this that's very, very important and critical. How much work do you put in? Let me set this up.
Love it. Yeah.
If you're going to be called on the carpet and you have to remediate something, that something better be worth calling people on the carpet and making them do things. How do you do a good job of getting high quality, highly synthesized and correctly prioritized vulnerabilities? I feel like that's a huge critical part of this.
Yeah, there's a bunch of critical parts. So also the ownership model, making sure that we are a high response security team as well. So we've always done a pretty good job. Like my goal has always been 2-3% false positives at most, because you want to have the trust of the engineering team. And I'm not saying we get it right all the time. We do definitely get it wrong, and we solicit feedback from engineering. We prefer when they provide us feedback and say, I disagree. We have a much better conversation when it comes to with respect to that. It is.
Those two. I love that. Yeah.
They do trust us. We are not, we don't want to be heavy-handed. At the end of the day, engineering is also driving the business and generating a lot of profit for the, or a lot of revenues for the company. So we definitely want to work with them with respect to that. But like, we also want to make sure that they are aware that there are consequences as well. So with respect to the ownership model, we are a monolith. We have strong service team catalogs within our monolith. If something goes wrong, it's easy for us to quickly change the team and make sure that the right team is jailed instead of the wrong team. And we are very, very high response. Fortunately for us, we have a large sizable team in India, but also a large sizable team in North America as well. So we have good coverage across the board. So if someone's asking or saying, hey, there's something wrong with this, we need you to look at it, we'll quickly jump in, unblock folks, and then move forward. And we listen a lot to our engineering teams. So we purposefully made vulnerability jail manual at the beginning. So we, this is because we want to make sure that we build the culture and build up the muscle for engineers to know that, hey, there's consequences for vulnerabilities going over SLA. So we wouldn't move them to the jail until we've probably bugged them a couple of times, and then they've moved them to jail. But over time, as they got better with it, we automated the entire process. And then we also continuously looked. They had concerns with some of our notifications. We changed how we did notifications. They had concerns with sometimes the wrong ownership. So say if there's one day left until we can be thrown into vulnerability jail, some teams look at things last moment. They know who they are. And then they'll assign it to the right team. And that right team has one day to fix the vulnerability, so which is unfair. So we've added a mechanism to automatically give an extension if that were to happen in itself. So there's a lot of work that we've done. We work really side by side with the engineering team to make sure that the process is smooth for them as well. And more recently, this is one of many jails that we have at Rippling. We have a feature flag jail. So if you're using too many feature flags, which adds a lot of technical debt in itself, people are always afraid to turn on or turn off feature flags. So we had a feature flag jail, so you can only use a certain amount. There's a number of other jails as well, but like, I don't think we were voted the best jail, but people were very appreciative of how well we work with the engineering team with response to vulnerability jail.
So it sounds like there was the concept already in the engineering org then before vulnerability jail came about with other types of jails, yeah, right?
We were the second jail. Yeah, so feature flag was the first jail. We liked the concept. We implemented vulnerability jail after that. So, yeah.
Okay, so it sounds like that, you know, the team being so responsive makes this effective and makes it so the developers aren't feeling like it's necessarily out of whack, right? Like that's always the, you know, the complaint from development is the security doesn't listen to, you know, development needs. And obviously the org, Rippling specifically is in a different space, I guess, right? Or so Bobby in comments has asked, sorry, I was trying to comment and then I coughed. What guardrails, I'll drop it up on the screen, have been put in place to prevent jail avoidance, either intentional or unintentional via models, such as scanners, milling, matching, but bones still present, right? He's getting more tactical into, okay, how would you deal with something like, scanner that you're running finds a vulnerability, the vulnerability exists in scan from last week, but it doesn't in this week, but you're already starting to jail someone because of that. Like what are the conditions? How are you dealing with that sort of a tactical issue?
Great question. We fully automated a lot of our tools just in general. So I'll give the example of SCA because that's a common type of vulnerability. You see a vulnerability within SCA. That's actually how we came to our ownership model as well. So vulnerability came within SEA. We got our ownership model. We signed it to the appropriate team. And they have a certain amount of time to remediate that vulnerability. So the way that we build out a lot of our tooling is that if the SEA is scanning all of the time, and we'll know if a vulnerability, everything is automated end to end. So anytime a new GitHub repo is created, we automatically add it to our scans. We scan constantly. If a new vulnerability is discovered, we'll create the vulnerability ticket, assign it to the appropriate team. If they fixed it, great. The scans will know that it's been fixed. So they'll auto-close the vulnerability tickets and they'll move on. So if it was signed to team A and team B fixed it, our scans will pick it up that it's been resolved. So we can auto-close it. Because ultimately, I always look at reducing the amount of effort on the product security team. This is operational toil and we want to reduce it. So anytime a vulnerability is automatically fixed, our scans will tell us it's fixed and we'll just close the vulnerabilities.
Again, being responsive, that's what I'm hearing, right? Like it's actually understanding the workflow and what pressures are being put on the team. So instead of just throwing it over the fence, you're still involved after that, the ticket or whatever else has actually been created.
Yeah, and that was actually V1 of Vulnerability Jail. So we talked a little bit about Mythos coming out, which really ramped up the intensity for us to be able to be capable to find vulnerabilities, but also remediate them faster. We're really worried about the pace in which we're fixing vulnerabilities. So the intensity went up quite a bit. So we built out this internal detection mechanism, diving into that will be a completely different chat. Well, I'll have to come on another day to talk about how that works. But we discovered a number of classes of vulnerabilities that we're seeing constantly in our bug bounty. So we created detections for it created a SAS detection, and then we validated with our DAST to make sure that it actually can be exploitable. And we did such a good job. We found like 1,400 vulnerabilities in the span of a couple of months. So we're finding a ton of these vulnerabilities. We're worried about how fast our threat actors can move. And we want to be able to fix these in a timely manner. It would be the worst if we had discovered a vulnerability and it was been 2 months, hasn't been fixed, and someone were to exploit it. So that'd be the worst case scenario for it. So what we did is that we started a war room. So we would get all of the people together and we'd have tranches, a set waves of vulnerabilities that we want to address. So we started off pretty slow, I think like 150 for 1 or 2 weeks, and got everyone accustomed to now moving at a faster pace. We also changed the SLAs. So typical SLAs, critical 7 days, high 30, medium 90, low 180. We change it to 3, 5, 7, and 10. So 3 days for critical, 5 days for high, 7 days for medium, 10 days for low. And our expectation is that we're gonna get faster and faster and faster with dealing with it. So a tranche of 150 vulnerabilities would be added to the war room. Very first set would have our CTO, CISO, and some of the VPs there. Engineering managers were all invited. The expectation is that they would have reviewed the vulnerability, made sure that it is achievable to fix it with an SLA, and then it was off to the races. I think like having the right leadership in the room was very helpful, but also setting the expectation for all of engineering that security is really important and we have to really address this. And Rippling has very sensitive information. We have payroll data, we have a lot of medical information. So having that sort of sensitive information in our ecosystem means that we have to react differently from other companies in itself. So engineers were on board as well. A little bit of pushback at the beginning, but they were on board. And we started seeing lots of vulnerabilities getting fixed and fixed and get fixed. So every week we released another 150, then 200. I think we maxed out at 430. We realized that was a little bit too many vulnerabilities for a week. Engineers were able to fix it, but there was a little bit more operational burden on the product security side of things. But like, so our goal is that we're going to be continuing to detect a lot more, but our expectation is that engineers have to fix even more than we're detecting in itself.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Ken.
Just a question around where are the vulnerabilities coming from? Are these like you're doing nightly or weekly scans, and these are SCA vulnerabilities, or you're doing those same scans and it's
Love it.
container vulnerabilities, or is it SAST vulnerabilities, DAST vulnerabilities? Like, what's kind of the general breakdown that we're talking about?
Yeah, it's everything. Our most is the detections that we have put into place. So we leverage our bug bounty to, that's the closest to real world that we have. So we look at, we mine that information. And I'll say that our bug bounty has gone way higher this year. I think a lot of researchers are using AI these days to detect vulnerabilities. So we're trying to figure out, okay, what are common classes of vulnerabilities that we're seeing there? We would build our own detections and scan all of our code because we have access to all of it. Why not scan it and find out what it is? If there is a framework level fix, we'll embed a security engineer with appropriate teams to make that framework level fix and then fix dozens or hundreds of vulnerabilities and close them off that way. But if there isn't, then we'll get the engineering team to actually remediate it quickly. So bug bounties are a big one. AI detection or AI tooling detection is the one that we built is another. SEA does come up. So it is literally everything that we throw at it.
Yeah, I was just trying to think, like, how can you ward off some of these things from, even getting to vulnerability jail to the system? And so to that end, I would imagine things like, so you could do this probably with some automation for SEA. You could, like, meaning not like necessarily, although that's the tough part with the SEA and like this automated auto updates, like not auto fixes, but just auto dependent bot kind of thing. It's like that does require typically someone to attest to this hasn't broken anything, but maybe that's an area where there's some automation. And then in terms of like, you said you built your own thing, right? For catching specific types of basically, it sounds like you've written policies that you enforce with agentic analysis or something like that. Very common strategy. But so there, that's why I wonder if like there you would imagine that their AI editor could just fix it right then and there in a PR versus like it ever getting and reaching to a PR or excuse me, a jail,
Oh, for
maybe
sure.
in ways.
We
Sorry, I'm
optimize.
just getting ways to shift lecture.
Exactly. We're on the exact same page. So our mandate initially was that we want to spend more time detecting because we don't know what the world is going to be like in a while. Let's not focus on detecting and providing fixes for these particular items. But we also realized that when we were providing PRs, I think I want to say about 50, 60% of them would get merged as is. But there were a lot of changes to the other. So every team had different requirements. So some teams wanted more tests, some teams wanted formatted something differently. So we have our goal is to build up that approval flow so that it's maybe 80, 85% in itself. And then we'll feel more comfortable with it. But like we still have a long ways to go to really understand how the teams want the PRs to be dropped onto their plates. And PRs, auto PRs is also a thing where it requires a cognitive load on the engineers. So our engineers are expected to, like everyone vibe codes these days, but our engineers are expected to review all the code, make sure that they are comfortable with shipping whatever it has been created. So it does have a cognitive load on the engineering team. So we're trying to find a way that, again, collaborate with them to get to a point where we can actually auto-generate these PR with these vulnerability tickets so that they can sign off on it. And then we talked a little bit about token budgets. Auto PRs actually require token budgets for it as well. So if you're only getting 50% acceptance rate, you're burning a lot of tokens for not getting it moved forward. So we have to sort of think about how to.
That I get.
So we're still mulling the right way to push forward on that.
So
Yeah.
and
Well,
that was my question. Oh, finish that up, Ken. Go ahead.
No. I was just coming at it more from less about like you submitting PRs, more about you giving feedback into developer tooling where it automatically fixes that issue. That's really what I meant. However, that is still an issue when it comes to CVEs specifically, or even CVEs on containers, CVEs with SCA. And then you're back to that, exactly what you're talking about, which is like this auto-crafted PR stuff, which I'm adamantly, I don't believe in. I have never seen it work. Yeah. If someone could show me a case study where it works, I'll eat my words, but I have never seen it work in practice. So it's always been silly to me because it's we'll just submit the PRs for them. And then there still has to be, like you said, work done to validate what you've written. And it may not be all that great either.
Yeah.
Maybe okay with AI, but or better. But anyways.
Yeah.
We're on the same page. Sorry, Seth. What were you gonna say?
Yeah, just to hit that point. We do look at, we mine our vulnerability information to find out if there are ways to do framework level fixes. Because ultimately we don't want engineers to worry about security. Ideally, we fix it at the platform and then they can go on and do their thing at the product level. So definitely ways to mine it just to see where can we actually fix it at the framework level, close off dozens or hundreds of vulnerabilities, and then engineers don't even have to worry about these vulnerabilities themselves.
So you're just trying to tackle it all angles, which is I think if you're going to make a program like this, something kind of have to.
We're appropriate. We still have to prioritize our efforts as well, but wherever it makes sense, we fix it. Or if we can fix it for them, great. If we embed with the engineering team and we fix it together, great. Or if we just tell the platform team, hey, we have no bandwidth, this is what we think needs to be done. Can we get this prioritized on your backlog? So we'll look at all these different type of collaborations that we can do with folks.
Yeah. My question, as AI comes into this, especially with the ambitious SLA that you've set, wholly appropriate with what's going on with agent swarms and everything that we're seeing, bug bounty as well, the number of vulnerabilities that are popping out, right? I think that's going to become more the standard. But with that, you're talking about your ProdSec engineers specifically, you're talking about security engineering, where are you applying your own use of AI across that spectrum? I think that becomes interesting as people, especially in our space where we're not necessarily AppSec and ProdSec, yes, when we code, using something like Codex or Claude is appropriate, but as you're doing vulnerability research and other things, it applies as well. So, how is it that you're utilizing those tools? What is your token spend look like as opposed to developer token spend? I'm asking a lot of questions, but you're talking through your AI strategy there.
So. Yeah. So security teams have to use AI. There's no way for us to keep up. Before it was security teams have to do software development because there's no way to keep up with engineering. Now we have to use AI. So a very specific example is that we talked a little about democratized vulnerability management, the vulnerabilities going to the right level. So when we had rolled out vulnerability jail, the vulnerabilities had to go to up to a VP or CISO or whatever initially. And what we ended up seeing is, especially when we automated vulnerability jail, a lot of these teams ended up in jail because the VPs, they're busy people. They have a lot of VP things that they're doing. They wouldn't be able to get to filing an extension or accepting an extension in time. So what we ended up doing is that anytime anyone had an extension request, we'll send it to AI. AI will analyze the plan, analyze the deadline, and say, hey, you're not aggressive enough. I think you should be more aggressive. So accept or reject it and provide the reasons for it. Again, this is a better experience for the engineers because they got immediate feedback as to why the vulnerability extension was rejected. So they're like, okay, there's no plan. So you have to clean a plan so AI can do some sort of analysis on it. Or you're asking for a month, we think you can be more aggressive with it. So they got immediate feedback so they can iterate and get an extension request that will be suitable for the security team and engineering team. So we have used AI in a number of different ways. We talked about detecting vulnerabilities, but also we want to make sure that we're always looking at our operational workload and engineering team operational workload when it comes to security and continuously reducing that over time. I rather have my engineers focus on building products, and I rather have my product security engineers focus on reducing risk rather than just maintaining the systems that we have.
Now, this is something that Seth and I talk about when we teach our course on like how to build different product, like AppSec products with AI, is that like you can weaponize institutional knowledge. You know, I mean, first you have to, like, one of the techniques we say is like, look, pick a service, pick a repo, like start with one that you know a lot about, transcribe yourself, talk about all the weird things that go on, like just do a video interview of yourself, like talking about all that, transcribe it, put it into a document, vectorize it. And now you can feed that as like a Q&A to your engineers. Like if they need a first level triage, like meaning conversation about like, how should I be doing? I got a DOM-based XSS finding in whatever. And so like, I like, how would I go about fixing that? What is that? Like, what's our recommended way of handling that in XYZ code base? And it's like, well, if you've like vectorized that institutional knowledge and written it down and made it accessible and a referenceable, I don't know if that's the right way to say that. But if you can do that, then like, you don't need to be the person, you don't need to be a human being responding to these things. You have like something that you can somewhat trust, always eval, always observe, but somewhat trust to a degree.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And that's definitely a journey that we're still on in itself. We are building our on-call Slack bot that we're hopefully helping us reduce the toil on the team. But like, you have to have good data, good documentation put in place so that AI can do the heavy lifting there. So yeah, I totally agree with you there.
So what is it that you're actually like, so what technology are you using to do this, right? Like, is this all custom, like homegrown, all right, like Python, you know, whatever else? Are you depending on some other framework or workflow solution? How have you gone about that?
Yeah, so it's a combination, Seth. So we've definitely done a lot internally, but engineering teams have built out a lot of the agentic platforms themselves so that we can leverage. So we make calls to the platform. We can choose the different type of models that we want for specific. One of the examples that that we're working through is we're looking at PR reviews, building our own PR review tooling. And some models work really good with certain situations. So we are able to sort of do analysis and figure out which models we use for this PR review in itself. So the platform that has been built, we've built one of our own, which we're using Flu, Langsmith, just the regular tools in itself. But we also leverage a lot of the engineering team platform as well.
Okay. I mean, that's what I would expect to see, right? Like in most organizations. I know that there are the workflow tools that are out there that, you know,
I should mention those as well.
Non-coder, right? Like, or they're geared more towards, I don't know, business people, I should say, right? Like where they can utilize AI and actually get some of those benefits. But if you really want to go to the level of integration that that your team is going to, I don't see a way. Well, I shouldn't say there isn't a way to use those tools. I'm sure it would be.
Done, right? Yeah. So we definitely use tools like Prefect that will help us with automation in itself. But like it really depends on the situation. We have a few, we have a couple of ingrown home ones, platforms that we use, but we also use, so we always look at the situation and what it calls for, which platform makes the most sense for us to use there.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's a lot changing of evaluation.
It is evaluation. Things are changing so quickly in itself. Like, I'm hoping these things stick around for a few months or a quarter before we have to rip it all out and start all over again.
Well, with that, right? Like, frontier models or open weight models? Like, what's your let's have a spicy discussion here, right? Like,
So, we talked a little bit about token usage, and it's rippling similar to other companies. We're using, our token usage was going up, up, and up, and the costs were going up, up, and up as well. And the business told us, you have to be very comfortable with us swapping out the frontier models. At some point, if one of them goes away, don't be surprised. And one of them did go away. So we all had to get used to being able to swap things out. So a lot of us use PyDev now. That we don't have to worry about, like, you can swap out whatever you want. We can just use whatever model is. So I think
we use that.
Yeah, it's fantastic. So we use Herder with PyDev.
Use that.
Yeah.
Herder with PyDev, yeah.
We have to get used to these tools that make it flexible for us. So the frontier models are really good. I still use it for a lot of my analysis in itself. But if I were to write any code, I don't mind giving it to open weight model itself. So I don't mind the heavy lifting, the deeper thinking analysis going with the frontier models and going heavy on the frontier models there, spending the good money there. And then execution is easy. Code execution is not expensive these days.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, that's what I wanted to hone in. This is why I was asking, because it does feel like the way that your team is implementing it is very much in line with Ken and I, our thinking and what we've seen and we've experienced as well, that the ability to flip, the ability to do evaluations, the ability to actually do observations of what's going on with those models for whatever task you're trying to accomplish makes it a lot easier to switch from one model to another, to be able to pick the right model for the job. That's why I haven't necessarily been like, oh, are you using GPT-5.5 or 5.6, right? Like, whatever it is,
yeah.
Because it changes so quickly, right? From yesterday to today to with the latest DeepSeek, the latest whatever, right? Like, from Anthropic or OpenAI, yeah. Like, whether it is a frontier or an open source model, the task becomes more important than the engine that's actually running it. So
agreed.
The evaluations model and the harness. Yeah.
Yeah. The models have gotten so much better. Like, a year ago to now, it is crazy how much better, all of them have gotten, the open weight ones, as well as the frontier models. Finding vulnerabilities in the past was more challenging, a lot more hallucinations, a lot more false positives. I've seen some of the stuff that, even past week, some of my team members have discovered, oh my God, they're moving faster and faster and faster, finding scarier and scarier, scarier things.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm actually seeing the same thing on the Dynamics side when we're looking at, customer applications as well.
Yeah. It's
what we initially developed a year ago, and we would struggle with even just kind of basics of, authorization issues or whatever it is. Now it's those are almost a non-issue. Yes. Identifies them reliably, and we're finding, more and more nuanced things without that much more prompting or harness engineering and other things, on top of it. And it's wholly due to the engine that we're using behind the scenes. But again, if you didn't have the evaluations, the ability to flip, it becomes a lot harder to actually, make those changes. I mean, Ken and I have this discussion constantly with the amount of evaluations that they have on their side as well. I don't know. Really, I don't know where it's going to go. Okay. So with that, what are your predictions? I know we're almost at top of the hour, and we've only been talking for 10 minutes, right? Like, whatever, right? It goes so quickly when you're digging into this stuff. What's your prediction? We're not going to wait 3 years, Jeeva.
Yeah.
We're going to, 3 years. That's basically, 2 weeks nowadays, right? So,
About a month ago, my prediction is I'm going to be out of a job in a couple of years. And then now I'm okay, I think I'm going to be employed for a while just with how crazy some of the stuff is happening in the industry with autonomous agents attacking, breaking out of their sandboxes, communicating with one another to break out of their sandboxes and discover vulnerabilities. Yeah, I think I think we're safely should be employed for at least another 2 years before things go bad again.
Okay, 2 years, right? Like, we'll talk and see where it's at. You know,
yeah, you might find me on a farm somewhere.
Yeah. We'll send you a message via your directory listing or something. I don't know. That was one of the fascinating things. And we didn't even talk about like OpenAI's presentation at Black Hat about what happened with Hugging Face, right? Like fascinating to see how the agents communicated with each other, you know, and initially they took away the, you know, the file upload functionality were using. And then it started to use just like the directory creation as the communication mechanism between these agents, because there wasn't a limit on the size of the directory that they could create. I was like, this is amazing, right? Like, it's frightening and amazing all at the same time.
Completely agree. Like, I think we're about to embark on some really interesting times. The problem sets that are going to be out there are going to be, it's going to be really fun for us. It's going to be scary. It's going to be hard. The next 12 to 18 months is going to be challenging, but it's going to be very interesting. A lot of learnings are going to happen. A lot of growth is going to happen for not just us individuals, but for the whole industry. So like, this is a great time to be a security engineer.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, the names are going to change, right? Like the companies that are there.
Have a hard stop right now? Because I do have one question, actually.
Yeah. I'm good.
You're good? Okay. Because this is actually in this, because you said, you're like, well, you know, cyber, it's a great time to be in the cybersecurity market. I actually agree with that. And I will say, like, just as a side note, I was getting pretty bored with like the 509th way that I'd seen some variant of XSS. That was getting boring. This is actually great. But that aside, while I do agree that I think it's really, really a great time, I also see on Reddit posts where people, I don't see them as much in Slack anymore. I mostly see this on Reddit, where people are questioning the cybersecurity market. They're questioning the security market in general. Should I get into it? They're also questioning things like the value of certs and if certificates are, you know, still hold the weight they did. So as somebody who hires people, I feel like it would be really beneficial to get your take on if I'm, you know, what's the line, junior to mid, maybe. How do I get to a rippling, or maybe I'm not. Maybe I'm somewhere adjacent to that. I don't know.
Yeah, we had a strong internship program that finished in June, and I think we converted 3 of those interns into full-time employees. I am very impressed by the new people that are coming into our industry. They are sharp, they are eager, they're really hungry. And being able to mold individuals like that has been fantastic. So the things that I tell that next generation, those are some things I look for. And I also see that all of our worlds are colliding. We had AppSec, we had CloudSec, we had corporate security. We have all of these different domains, and I sort of slowly see them collapsing. Like, especially at the higher levels, I'm expecting strong infrastructure security and product security knowledge for the people that I hire. Like, they definitely have to be able to know how to use AWS or GCP really, really well, and be able to provide good ways forward or build solutions themselves. So like for the new generation, I do want them to be very comfortable in any of those domains, but also corporate security. So I do think teams will get, now Seth, you got making me do predictions, Seth. I do think teams are gonna get leaner, but I think that we're gonna have a lot more breadth in knowledge itself. Like the depth, AI will help us with the depth in itself. So for the new people coming out, I've been harping on this for a long time. You have to think like an engineer. You have to be an engineer. And I always recommend people do a lot of software development just in general, so they understand what it means to be an engineer, what are the challenges that they face too. So when you actually work closely with them, you can empathize with them and really find ways to embed with them so that you can move, reduce risk and move your program forward in itself. So be engineers. I want more engineers out there. I don't mind even hiring engineers and converting them to security folks as well. We've built out a strong platform security programs because we have these really, really strong engineers that are interested in security. It's much easier to teach an engineer security than a security person how to do engineering work. So yeah, I'm really focused on really hiring engineers at any sort of level.
And I guess that work too allows them to network and to meet people and to put their work out there. And I guess that's kind of leading me to the further second level question there, which is like, how do I get your attention? How do I get one of your hiring managers' attention? Is that through open source work, through bug bounties?
Yeah.
People are talking about like putting in these resumes and AI systems, like kicking out, like rejecting 450 people right off the bat, stuff yeah. like that. So I feel like there's a need to be in front of people. And you know, is that,
yeah,
how would I, in the modern day, sorry, it's okay if you don't yeah. have an answer, but I'm just, if you do, that'd be amazing. Cause
yeah.
I
always hear about these systems. So I've manually reviewed a lot of resumes in general. I know my team right now, since we get so many, we have a recruiting team that actually manually reviews all these resumes and provides some criteria in itself. But like, if you don't have much experience, I would look at your open source contributions or projects that you have worked on. And especially these days, there's definitely a level of expectation on how much AI you're using. So I will bring that up in a hiring manager interview where I will specifically ask some of the biggest problems you've solved with AI in itself and really dive into the weeds there. So if someone doesn't have much experience, look at building out projects, look at how you've used AI to solve really difficult things in itself. And that's what I also encourage my nieces and nephews that are looking to break into the industry as well.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that focus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everyone's going to be an engineer.
Yeah, exactly. That's absolutely right. Like, you know, the use of AI is blurring the lines between what was traditionally like, oh, software, security, like whatever, engineering, because now it's just the principles of how do you go about engineering something, and then you can specialize from there on top of it, but it still is utilizing those same tools. I've been telling people like where I used to use Burp Suite on a daily basis, right? Like that was my main interface for testing. That has changed. I'm now just like any other engineer. I use a coding agent, and that's how I interact with the world and even with the internet, and right, like because it's more efficient and it's faster and I get to the answers quicker. But being able to do that presupposes that you understand how to think like an engineer, yes. how to actually interact with those tools. So that is great advice, Jivan. Good. Well, we have been going for an hour, so I want to be conscious of your time. We are going to have to do a follow-up. I know that in less than 3 years this time
around. Less than 3 years, yeah.
Yeah, that's crazy to me. I went and looked, and I was like, oh, yeah, it was, you know, 100-plus episodes ago the last time
that we had
Jivan on. It doesn't feel like it's been that long, but, you know, it has been, right?
Actually, but to his credit, though, I will say this because, like, I think this is something people should know about you. Like I had reached out to Jivan, I think more than once, right? And he was like, look, I only want to speak if I have something to speak of value. And there's something about that you just don't see. This day and age, it's rare. Everybody wants attention. They need engagement, this, that, and the other. So I respect the hell out of anybody who's like, you know what? I don't need to speak until I have something worth speaking about. And then, of course, as soon as you had something worth speaking about, or in your mind worth, because anything you say is worth speaking about to me. But anyways, as soon as you had something, then we were able to collaborate on getting this coordinated and all that. But yeah, it's a cool thing, man. Not everybody's like that. Good for you. You're a good guy.
Yeah.
Respect you.
Appreciate it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we appreciate having you on. We'll go ahead and close it out for today. Great work over at Rippling. You know, keep us apprised of where you're at. Like I said, let's chat within, you know, probably early next year at the latest to see where the program has gone. I'd be interested to hear how Vulnerability Jail is progressing and how it's changed over time, especially as vulnerabilities ramp up. Just the fact that you're closing 150 a week with your, you know, 3, 5, 7, 10 SLA is fascinating to me.
I'd love to introduce the biggest 450 in 1 week, which was wild. It was wild. Yeah.
Yeah. That's wild, but also, great stuff to Bobby's point. So, and I think, if people have other questions, that was my last statement. Where can they find you, or where could they reach out to you to interact?
LinkedIn is probably the easiest. Hit me up on LinkedIn. I respond to everyone. It may take me a few days, but I will definitely get back to people.
Okay, great. So find it on LinkedIn.
Yeah, and I'm hiring. So if you are a staff, a security engineer looking at changing the world, hit me up. We'll love to chat with you and see if there's a mutual fit there.
Yeah, I'm actually trying to find the link right now. I'll put it in our, for those listening, I'll put it in our jobs channel of Absolute AppSec.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you for your time today, Jivan. Thanks to everyone for listening. If you haven't joined Slack, please do so. If you need an invite, reach out info@absoluteappsec.com and we will get one across to you. And yeah, otherwise, let me know how the vulnerability reduction goes and whether or not you can introduce vulnerability jails into your organization. I'd love to hear more stories. All right. Thanks, everyone. Have a nice week.
Thanks for... Yes, thank you. I can't talk. It's